wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Now, last time I actually let that sting play throughout the entire duration because I had never done this before, but we're not doing that today. How are you, Kushla, today?
Very well, thank you. I'm glad I'm not camping.
Yeah, no, definitely not the weather. And I was texting Castor before and his reception is also cutting out. So not the best way to be spending your summer, unfortunately, but hopefully this weather clears up sometime soon. Now, what do we have on today, Kushla?
So today we've got kind of an archival theme to the three stories, just because they were observations that have been made a long time ago but not really capitalized on, or they've required archives to discover. So right. The first story. Imagine we're 95 million years ago, we're in North Africa, and you're wandering around and suddenly you see this 10-meter long carnivorous dinosaur. So you're probably going to start running.
Probably, perhaps. Yeah. Yep.
Had sharp symmetrical teeth, and it had this prominent nasal horn. And this has just recently gotten a new name, this fossil that was this dinosaur. Now, I'll excuse pronunciation here. Tamiriraptor magraphi. And as I said, like, it wasn't recently discovered. So actually this skeleton was excavated in 1914 from the Baharia Oasis in Egypt. And then it was sent to Munich. A lot of time, a lot of fossils used to just get sent up into Europe for study. And it was described and reported by a paleontologist, Ernst Stromer van Reichenbach. Goes by the name, everyone just refers to him as Stromer. And he basically assigned it to this genus that he'd come up with, Carcharodontosaurus. So these things had sharp teeth.
Yeah.
And then they stored the skeleton with a whole bunch of other Egyptian dinosaurs they found in what that was called the Bavarian State Collection for Paleontology and Geology, and it was in the Old Academy in the centre of Munich. Then, as we all know, there was World War II.
Yes.
July 21st, 1944, the Allies had an air raid over Munich and they bombed the building.
Right.
Not aiming for the building, but it collateral damage.
So
a large part of this collection was dust after this. And so all we are left with were notes that Stromer had made, some illustrations of the bone, and a few photos. So it was basically, essentially, this dinosaur was forgotten.
Yeah.
Until we had a master's student, Maximilian Kellermann. And he was going through some archives at the University of Tübingen in Germany and suddenly found these photos of this fossil that no one had really remembered existed. And so he was looking at it with his supervisor and some other paleontologists, and they were like, this doesn't really look right for this genus of Carcharodontosaurus. It was lacking some things and it had some other things. And so also, there's been a lot of discoveries in the meantime. You know, 1914 was a wee while ago. And so in Morocco, they've discovered a lot of these types of fossils. And so they were looking at these things. And the photos showed that the skull had this prominent nasal horn. It had an enlarged frontal brain. And it was missing some other features that you would have expected. And so they decided that they have enough evidence that they've got a new species. And so this is why they've named this new species Tamiriraptor magraphi. And that's basically the etymology of their name is... an ancient name for Egypt, which meant the promised land, was Tamir. And then it also honours Richard Margraf, who was the fossil collector that worked for Stromer and, like, had sent this back to Munich. And this is kind of rare that, you know, a paleontologist usually won't name a new species unless they lay hands on the actual fossil, bones and stuff. But they were like, this is kind of an exceptional case. There's so much evidence that it doesn't really fit here. You know, when we can't get the fossil back. So they've named it. And it's basically, you know, it's kind of an indication that for paleontologists, beyond digging in the ground, you know, digging in the archives can also be quite helpful.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Very, very interesting. If you were to say this might not be a question you might know, but, like, if you were to say this dinosaur is as close compared to another dinosaur, what dinosaur would that be? Because it seems like quite a unique species of dinosaur.
I did read that and I've completely forgotten the name. Sorry. so I think it is still, they do say, like, even though it's a new species and it's not in the same genus as these Carcharodontosauruses, it's still kind of somewhat similar. When I first saw raptor in the name, I thought maybe it was close to that, but it didn't really seem to be that within the little reading that I did. But they were... They did, you know, as all good dinosaur stories, they do mention a T-Rex, but it's nowhere near. nowhere near related.
Yeah. No, fair enough. Also, cool. So do you want to What's our next topic? We have three topics lined up for you for listeners today.
Okay, so the next one's in Naples, in Italy. There's a museum, an archaeological museum, and it has this 2100-year-old mosaic that depicts the moment Alexander the Great led the final charge against this Persian king, Darius III. And it's in need of some restoration. But before you can restore these things, you obviously need to understand the materials and the stability. So first off, just a bit of history, because I always think it's kind of interesting. 333 BCE, so before now, on what's now the modern border between Syria and Turkey, there was this battle between Alexander the Great and the Persian king Darius III. And it was reported that Alexander the Great and the Greeks, there was like 75,000 of them, and with the Darius III and the Persians, there was 600,000. There was this battle with Alexander the Great, and it kind of cemented his, you know, why we remember him as this great general and everything. Now we kind of consider that those numbers were somewhat exaggerated.
Yeah.
But it made for a good story for 2,300 years, right?
Oh, yeah, love that.
But now, you know, looking at logistics and stuff, probably not 600,000.
Yeah, that is a lot. That is a lot of people. Yeah.
No debate that probably the Persian, there were a lot more Persians on that side than the Greeks, but, you know, you're not all that many people. And about 200 years after this battle, this mosaic was made for the House of Faun in Pompeii. Depicting this battle. And this mosaic is six meters by 3 meters and consists of 1.9 million tiles.
1.9 million?
Yep. None of these tiles are more than 4 millimeters long.
So like very, very, very tiny.
Yeah. Tiny, right?
Very
it's
tiny.
Highly detailed. It's very intricate. Sorry. Go on, because I stumbled. And so obviously you want some non-invasive methods to study this, right? You're not going to start pulling pieces off this.
Absolutely not, no.
And it was, you know, it was built for this house in Pompeii, but it's actually been moved to this museum in 1843. And so what they've done is they've used a whole bunch of different techniques. They've used something called multispectral imaging, which is, you think of it as you're taking photos, but instead of using just visible light, red, green, blue, you're actually selecting specific wavelengths. So you can start to get chemical information. You can start to see signs of surface degradation, evidence for past treatment. They've used a technique called portable X-ray fluorescence, which just gives you elemental information. So is there calcium? Is there iron, lead? And then they've used some other methods, infrared and Raman spectroscopy, which starts to tell you about the chemicals in there. Or infrared thermography, which is heat sensing, basically, because it starts to give you information about where the thing might be unstable. And then you just look at it. We're using optical microscopy, so in really fine detail. Or they've also, which I found really cool, was they've used an endoscope. So an endoscope, we usually think of it as a thing that gets put down your throat, the surgeon looks at your gut and stuff. Well, they've used one of these endoscopes to go behind the mosaic, because there's regions that aren't against the wall, and you can kind of start to see, you know, where past restorations happened and where someone's like maybe packed some paper in because it was falling down and stuff like this. And so they've used all these different techniques to start to get a sense of how this thing was made, how it's been restored over time, because, you know, it is really old, so people have touched it up and maybe not kept the best records of that.
Yeah.
And figure out, okay, what are we going to do? And so this paper was really about what they've found. So they found on the surface there was wax. They think this is from a 19th century restoration. They found there were little bits of gypsum, and they think this is probably from the protective layers that were put around this mosaic when it was transported to this museum in 1843. Using the infrared thermography, they found some sites where they think there's probably some instability that wasn't associated with past restoration, and so they've got new information. Like, we need to be really careful in these areas.
Yeah.
And they're also able to basically divide these tiles into four groups based on their colour and their chemistry, right? So they had some carbonate-based tiles, which these tended to be white, pink, red, yellow, green, and light blue. And so these probably were made from the marbles of the region.
Mm.
You got silica-based tiles, which were black, green, and grey. So these were from the volcanic or the metamorphic rocks of the region. Then you had some vitreous sort of tiles, which are more your yellows, greens, and browns. And so glasses are from the area. And then some black and red tiles, which they just said had elevated levels of iron and manganese. And so now they still have a bit of work to do. Like, they've got to analyse the mortar that's holding the tiles in place and do a bit more imaging. But Yeah, it's kind of a really nice example of you basically putting together a puzzle.
No, fair enough. A very, very intricate... How many was it? 1.4 million?
1.9 million.
1.9 million. Oh, my goodness gracious. Okay, quickly, we have our last topic, if you want to introduce that.
Cool. So this is just lipocartilage. And so why this caught my eye was because the title was basically Scientists Discover a New Type of Skeletal Tissue. And like, you're like, really? Are we still discovering new things about the body? But we are. It's, you know, it's amazing.
The body's a weird place.
It is, right?
Very weird.
And so what's really interesting about this as well is that we're clues dating back to 1854 for this, but it kind of got forgotten. And so in 1854, a scientist noticed that there was fat droplets and cartilage in rat ears and called them lipochondrocytes, and that was all they kind of did. And now we have this new lipocartilage, which is essentially, it's kind of like bubble wrap. It's soft and springy cartilage.
Right.
So in our bodies, we have lots of different forms of cartilage. Well, we have several different forms of cartilage. One is like an example is hyaline cartilage, so that covers the end of your joints so that they move smoothly. You have fibrocartilage. One of the places you find it is the connection between your tendons and ligaments to the bone. And usually this cartilage is, it has cells, which we call chondrocytes, and then it has extracellular matrix, which is water, collagen, and some proteoglycans and some other stuff. And the strength of this cartilage really comes from that extracellular matrix. Well, lipocartilage, which is found in the ears, the nose, and the throat of mammals, is unique in that it has, its cells, which we're calling lipochondrocytes, are filled in fat. And they're uniquely packed so that it forms this super stable internal support that means that the tissue is soft and springy. So you can imagine it's great for, you know, like the tip of your nose or your earlobe, where it has to be flexible. You know, it's compliant and it's elastic, this tissue. And it's really, what they've discovered is actually these fat cells, they're really important to this, the mechanical properties of this cartilage. So in our bodies, we have adipocytes, fat cells, and if these will shrink and expand depending on what we're eating, right? These lipochondrocytes don't. They just maintain their size and they stay fat-filled, which is really unique as well. And so to discover this, these scientists had to do a lot of biochemistry using a lot of modern biochemical tools. They had to do a lot of imaging and stuff to show that if they starved the mouse or they fed the mouse or they just gave it a balanced diet, lipids didn't disappear from these cells. They stayed the same because they need it for that mechanical strength or that soft and springiness. And if you did manage to remove the lipids from these cells, the tissue became brittle and it was no longer. So it really is like, it really kind of is like the bubble wrap, right? The air bubbles and you know, your fat bubbles. Yeah. And so also the one other thing they found was the packing of these fat cells was really important. So they found in bats, along the ears, you know, bats have got the big ears, right? Because they're really sensitive hearing. It was in the fat cells kind of packed in parallel ridges and stuff. And so, yeah, it was really interesting.
That is very interesting. Now, with this bubble wrap, if you were to pop it...
Well, yeah, no, it, yeah.
Would it make the bubble wrap noise?
Probably not.
Oh, that's a little bit disappointing.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Probably not, but...
Oh, well, scientists need to figure that out. Well, I think that's all we have from you today, Kushla. Thank you very, very much for joining us on this week's episode of Dear Science. And thank you, Motat. Love you guys. Awesome.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.